On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Project Risk Management for Site Remediation. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Remediation Risk Management Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Remediation Risk Management Team. Today's training course is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Project Risk Management for Site Remediation. We call it the RRM-1 document. We're going to introduce you to this document during today's training, and we do encourage you to review the document after the training class. We're going to take you to a link at the end where you can download a PDF of the document. We also make available the presentation that you'll see during the training. In addition to what you're going to see on the slides during today's class, we have more information available in the notes section of the downloaded version. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. On slide 2, if you're unfamiliar with this version of CLUIN, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and each of you in the audience are in control of your own slides. The slide number is listed in the upper left-hand corner, and most often you're going to use that third button, the single right arrow, to move forward through the presentation. The trainers will say the slide number as we go through today's presentation. Today's class is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We're going to have question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end. For the phone line audience, if you don't mind holding your questions until the question and answer breaks, we appreciate that. For the simulcast audience and anyone else who wants to, that orange question mark button at the top of the screen allows you to send in questions and comments. And you can do that throughout today's presentation. On our last slide, we have a link to our feedback form. We really do use the feedback you provide and appreciate you taking just a few minutes as you wrap up today to give us your feedback. Today's class is being recorded, and we offer archives of past ITRC classes. On slide 3, you can learn more about ITRC at the ITRC website, and we list that at the top of the slide. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. More information is available on the ITRC website, and I do encourage you to visit the website. We have new teams starting in 2015, and you can learn how to be more involved in ITRC. On slide 4, I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers are members of the ITRC Remediation Risk Management Team. Dr. Ningwu Chang is a senior hazardous substance engineer with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, located in Cypress, California. He has extensive experience in water and wastewater treatment system evaluation and design, soil and groundwater remedial investigation, remedial systems evaluation and design, industrial waste minimization, and permitting and compliance. Ningwu was the team leader of the ITRC Remediation Risk Management Team. Dr. Sam Brock is the Air Force subject matter expert for environmental risk assessment and toxicology. He provides technical consultation to the team, determining functional requirements for risk reduction, authoring articles and technical reports, and assisting in developing educational and training programs. Dave Becker is a geologist with the Environmental and Munitions Center of Expertise at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Omaha, Nebraska. He provides technical consultation, teaching, review of environmental restoration-related documents, and preparation of guidance relevant to field studies and in-situ remediation. On slide 5, I'll now turn today's training over to Ningwu Chang. Ningwu?
Thanks, Juliana. We're going to start our training on slide number 5 here. As we learn from the past remediation experiences, we understand that the remediation has a lot of the so-called inherent uncertainties all the way from the investigation phase through the remedy implementation. So in other words, there are quite a risk involved in the remediation process. And as defined by the Project Management Institute, the project risk is an uncertain event or condition that if it occurs, has a positive or negative effect on that. It's one of the project objectives. Now, from the project management point of view, most likely we're focused on the negative effect on the risk, and also the project objectives were probably more focused on the project schedule or project cost. Now move on to slide number 6. Now, you may have experienced one of the situations that happened to one of my sites that's listed below here. For example, one of the sites, a simple dig and hole project, from very small excavation volume, we expanded significantly, and that caused a lot of delay in schedule and also increased the cost. And also, for some remission projects involve groundwater pumping tree or soil vapor extraction, the pumping tree capture zone may not be achieve what we desire for, or similar like radio of influence from the SPE system or the injection project for the direct injection may not achieve the desired radio of influence we want. And also, accidents does occur in our projects. And in one of our projects, we do have a fatal traffic accident from transporting the remediation hazardous waste to a treatment facility. And that also affect the how we're going to transport the waste and delay the project here. And also, in the past decade or few years, we see the fluctuation of the economics and see the price changes and oil price, that kind of stuff. And that has significant effect on one of our projects, which we use the high-density polyethylene as the landfill liners. And HDPE is a petroleum product, and it's also affected by the petroleum prices increase or fluctuation there. And that increased our the budget required to purchase that liner. So these are the project risks that may affect the overall schedule or cost to complete our project. Let's move on to slide number 7. So for that reason, we do need to think about how to manage the project risk in order to mitigate any of those negative outcomes through the remediation activities. As Juliana mentioned, today's training is based on the technical and regulatory guidance document titled the Project Risk Management for Site Remediation prepared by the ITRC Remediation Risk Management Team. And we're going to use the RRM, stands for Remediation Risk Management, the term throughout the training today. Let's move on to slide number 8. Okay. So today's training, we're going to present an overview and the principle and elements of the RRM to all the remediation practitioners in various programs in order to understand the importance and the benefit of the RRM. And we're going to also demonstrate how to implement the RRM with some case studies. And the goal of this training is to understand how we can manage the project risk in order to achieve a more successful remediation. Okay, slide 9. Today we also try to illustrate to the principle and elements as shown on this figure of the RRM process here. There are 3 principles shown on the top and 5 major elements. On identify, evaluate, mitigate, and monitor and reporting for the RRM process. And we will talk about this in details in this training here later. Okay, let's move on to slide 10. So today's outline of this training is here. We'll talk about the introduction, talk about the basic RRM definition and its benefits, and its evolution and our survey results. And following the introduction, we will talk about the overview and roadmap, the principles and elements, and the planning and implementation of the RRM. And after the first question and answer break, and we will then illustrate how to implement the RIM with some examples and case studies. At the end, we will have another question and answer period. Okay, now let's move on to slide number 11. Okay, now, so what is RIM? Basically, we have adopted industry standard project risk management concept to our remediation project. So in brief, we have defined the RRM as a course of action through which a broad set of project risks relate to site investigation, remedy selection, remedy implementation, and site closure are holistically addressed. Slide 12. Now, RRM can help you to your project against the so-called Murphy's Law, which is what can go wrong will go wrong, and try to meet the so-called the secondary project objectives while we try to achieve the overall objective, that is try to protect human health and the environment. And we'll talk about the what are those secondary project objectives later. Now, we do need to realize that the RRM is being done for site conditions that, because of this complex acidity for the site, and not because we did not try to do it correctly in the first place. And as we gather more information, assessing the project risk throughout the remedy implementation with the proper planning, executing, and verifying, those are three principles of the RIM, then we can make a better decision to move the project to success. Okay, slide 13 here. All right, we do like to point out we're talking about the project risk management here, not the the risk management aspect. Most people may be familiar with from their human health or ecological risk point of view. And most of you know that human health and ecological risk, which would drive the remediation, as one of the threshold criteria. And in the broader sense, picture or to protect human health and environment is we call it so-called a primary objective for remediation projects. Slide 14. Now, RRM does not address why a remediation is needed, and as we mentioned in the previous slides, that's addressed by the human health and risk point of view. Instead, address how remediation can be conducted and focus on the so-called secondary objectives. Now, here we use the secondary objectives to differentiate the primary objective we talked about in previous slides as those are the thresholds. Okay, here we just list some of the secondary objectives such as the cost, time frame, greenhouse gas emission, safety issues, etc. These secondary objectives may be similar to those we are typically evaluating our feasibility studies or corrective measure studies, but the RRM will address those issues further into what is called a what-if situation. Okay, next slide, slide 15. Now here's the figure shows the how those secondary objectives can feed into to make a help you make a project decisions. Here's just a typical secondary objective we are list here. Now, as you may see from this figure, some of those secondary objectives, such as the worker safety, and maybe very important in order to conduct a successful remediation project. Move on to slide 16. So by understanding the project risk associated with the remediation at the site, then we can plan ahead to reduce or mitigate the project risk in order for us to make a better decision to achieve our ultimate goal of protecting human health and the environment. Most importantly, and we try to avoid operating the project in a crisis control mode, which usually would be resource intensive, and also with the limited options that we can do to fix the problem. Slide 17. RIM, we do believe that applies to all the programs, remediation programs, CERCLA, RCRA, the USD programs, and all the, any size of the projects. For a large or complex project, RRM could be a standalone task. For the most of the project, we believe the RRM could be integrated with other project management activities, just with a different levels of efforts. For example, in one of my projects, we just talk about it during the meeting, evaluate during the meeting, and then document the RRM process in the meeting minutes. We will talk about the how to implement this later in this training. Slide 18. ICRC has developed a series of technical regulatory guidance documents through different teams related to so-called better management practice for remediation. As you see from this pyramid here, RRM is one of the most recent documents developed, and also the green and sustainable remediation technical regulatory guidance document is also published recently, and that training is also available. You will find these related documents on the ITSC website. Slide 19. Now, most directly, the RRM is a continuation from the performance-based environmental management. That's another guidance document prepared by the ITRC Remediation Process Optimization Team, RPO team. The performance-based environmental management, PBEM, is a strategic, goal-oriented methodology that's implemented through effective planning and decision logic to reach a desired end state of site cleanup. There are several components in the performance-based environmental management, as you can see from this figure here. But each one of these components involves certain project risks. And so in order to enhance the implementation of the performance-based environmental management, the risk management has to be considered as part of the performance-based environmental management. So on slide 20, here's a figure to demonstrate how the performance-based environmental management and the RRM as one of the better management practice tool fit into a typical restoration program. And as you can see from this figure here, the performance-based environmental management and the risk management components identified throughout the restoration process, all the way from the preliminary assessment all the way to site closure. Slide 21. Now, before we prepare this guidance document, we conduct a state survey engaging their input on RRM. At the time of the survey, there are only a few familiar with the concept of RRM. And from the responses, as shown from this chart here, the most important risk was remedy implementability or the remedy performance. The least important risk associated with the regulatory aspects. Slide 22. In addition, regarding the challenge in groundwater remediation, from the survey, most states will consider alternative approaches, such as monitoring natural attenuation and land use control was most popular, and the alternative concentration limit, ACL, approach was less commonly considered. And the consideration of these alternatives could be a part of the RRM mitigation approach during the groundwater remediation. So with today's training, we hope that the remediation practitioner in various programs, in order to get familiar with the RRM concept and how to implement it then. So with that, next we have Dr. Sam Brock to talk about the RRM roadmap and elements. Sam?
Thank you, Ningwu. If we can go now to slide 22, we'll look at where we're headed in the next few minutes. We're going to cover the a couple of blocks of instructions in some detail to get into the steps that we actually do to implement RRM. And we'll be looking at the overview and then a more in-depth discussion of some of the principles and elements. If we go now to slide 23, let's go to slide 24. As Ningwu mentioned, the objective of RRM is to help us manage MRFI. In other words, to anticipate events that might cause a disruption to our cleanup and to think about some contingency responses for how we would respond to that. This project process will continue from site discovery until site completion. And again, it's how we're going to respond to unexpected events. Let's go now to slide 25. The objectives of RRM are to manage or control the risk and to increase the likelihood of project success. We see this in the new EPA groundwater remediation completion strategy, where we're looking not only at having the right objectives, but making sure that we systematically proceed toward achieving those objectives. We want to reduce secondary impacts, safety considerations, or issues of technology performance. We want to minimize time and cost to achieve cleanup, and RRM principles will help us facilitate better planning and better communication with the project team. We go now to slide 26. As Ningwu mentioned, RRM applies throughout the site life cycle, starting with site discovery, but there are two areas where it applies perhaps more productively or with a greater focus. One would be in the remedy selection phase. In other words, in the feasibility study or site investigation, as we evaluate candidate technologies, we really want to look at the site-specific conditions with regards to selecting technologies that are appropriate to the site. And then once we have selected that technology and engaged in remedial construction, we want to make sure that we continue to monitor remedy performance to make sure it's making the progress we expect. If we go now to slide 27, this conceptual approach would apply to a variety of regulatory structures. A lot of us work in CERCLA, Superfund type activities. Many of us in the state activities will look at a RCRA-based scenario, a corrective measures approach, or in various substance programs like the UST programs. And what we'll find is that each one of these programs have a systematic process where the elements of identifying the objective and then obstacles to achieving those objectives with systematic planning to to enhance performance are highly beneficial. If we go now to slide 28, as Ningwu showed us earlier, we're going to now focus on the plan, execute, verify principles. It's a systematic process. And we're going to implement that with the five steps, which are the elements of the RRM, which is to identify the problem, evaluate the potential risks, think through steps or plans to mitigate that event should it occur, followed by monitoring to determine effectiveness of mitigation or the occurrence of the consequence of concern, and then reporting. And I want to call your attention to the feedback loops in here, because as we go through the site's life cycle, we're going to, based on monitoring data and progress of cleanup, we may need to revise our mitigation strategies. We may need to double-check our assumptions about technology effectiveness or adequacy of site characterization. And as we get into the operation of remedies, we may actually identify new risks or consequences that were initially unexpected. Go now to slide 29. The backbone of RRM is a written risk management plan. This is our project's early warning system, and it's important that we not only do the elements of evaluation and planning, but that we write it down. And then that plan is only helpful if it's actually implemented. So we want to look at the documentation, the implementation. We want to involve the appropriate stakeholders throughout the process to get a broader range of perspectives and a more effective plan. And we want to integrate RRM with our existing project management and reporting tools. We'll talk later on about RRM being scalable to the complexity of the project. But the objective of this is to embed the principles and practices into our current management activities. We're not particularly interested in a standalone document that's something else to check and track, but we are concerned that these procedures be implemented into our planning as a practical way of controlling project risk. Let's go now to slide 30. So, having completed the overview and a roadmap, and if you had to leave right now, you would have a key idea of how RRM fits into your project management. But what we want to do now is go into the principles and elements in a little more detail to talk about how we actually do this, the conceptual approach for thinking through our risk assessment and our risk management steps, and talk about the first principles that we would employ to actually build an effective risk management plan. Let's go now to slide 31. We've talked about the key principles, and the first of these is we'll implement those principles through five steps, which is the identification, the evaluation of risk, mitigation planning, monitoring of those events and plans, and reporting. And of course, we will emphasize the importance of the written plan. And we're really focused on the objective here of RRM can help us with compliance performance, and it can help us with cleanup performance. And again, we want to integrate that into our existing project objectives. We'll talk about using a risk register shortly, and you can find an example of a risk register at table 4-2 in the actual guidance document. If we go now to slide 32, Ning Wu mentioned in the introduction that often our remedies may fail to accomplish certain elements of our cleanup goals or may fall short completely in meeting our objectives. Our systems may underperform, our technology may function slower than we anticipated, and of course cost increases are a constant concern. And there are a number of factors that influence our successful site remediation, and these deal with the uncertainty or the unknowns or the variability that are inherent in our site conditions. We're dealing with natural environments, and there is a variety of circumstances that can cause our work to to go awry. RRM is about systematically applying the lessons learned from similar sites and then using that to leverage our process for cleaning up our particular projects. It's based on our experiences with remedial process optimization, and it's a concept that is used by a number of other areas, including Departments of Energy, Department of Defense, and EPA. If we go now to slide 33, again, we've been through these elements again, but we'll use them now to go through them in some more individual detail. At slide 34, the objectives of risk identification are to compile a list of potential risks which might affect our project. And we want to do this by considering a list of general considerations that are inherent to all sites. We also want to consider site-specific attributes that may affect the sorts of risks that we have to deal with. And we want to look at our project-specific risks. This might be inherent to the particular, not just the site, but to the contract vehicle or the technologies that we're preparing to deploy, because all of these variables will have impacts on what sort of risk events might occur. We have tools that can identify memory jogs on how to identify what risk we may need to evaluate. We want to engage in the use of checklists, engage our cleanup team in terms of managers and subject matter experts or technology experts that will allow us to get into the appropriate identification of activities that we need to look at. And we want to follow our work breakdown structure in terms of keeping a record of these items that we identify. In the tech reg, we've identified seven general areas dealing with human health, regulatory and economic issues of schedule and staffing. And you'll notice that a lot of these are in addition to our focus on technology performance. If we go now to slide 36, once we've identified or made our list of risk events of concern for our project, we want to then engage in the evaluation step. And this is where we actually look at assigning a level of risk to the particular events that we've identified that might occur. And we need to do this so that we can determine which ones are important. And risk is a function of the probability of occurrence and the consequence of that event if it does occur. And in the scenario that we'll go through in evaluation right now, we're going to use a qualitative register based on our judgment to evaluate these. However, as Ningwu mentioned, if it's a complex site and we have it in a case study toward the end, we can also use quantitative tools or statistical analyses to supplement the risk element. But if we go now to slide 37, and in our qualitative approach, we'll look at the likelihood of occurrence first, and is it very unlikely or is it highly likely? And we'll just use a simple four levels of evaluation here to identify. You can really use some judgment in terms of it. You can rate this as a 2x2 table, high and low, or you can spread that out a little bit if the risks are important. But the objective of this is to identify the likelihood of occurrence. Now, if we go to the next slide, slide 38, we now want to pair up the likelihood of occurrence with the consequence or impact of the event should it occur. And we run this across the x-axis, and what we end up with is a table with 20 or so cells in it where the level of risk has been qualitatively assigned as high, medium, and low. And the purpose of this exercise is that we want to focus on managing or mitigating those risks that are sufficiently important to be worth management attention to actually plan and execute a management strategy. If we go now to slide 39, this is an example of a risk register where we have identified individually a large number of risk events. We make a summary record in the table of what our risk evaluation resulted in, and this allows us to keep a record of what risks were identified as important and the basis for why we made that conclusion. And this may be important at a future time if some risk event was to change in terms of its importance or impact. We could quickly refer to this and know what we were thinking when we wrote the plan, and this would help us communicate and respond to an adjustment as we go forward. Now at slide 40 is where we get into the step where we actually say, okay, what is plan B? What are we going to do to either prevent this risk or to reduce the consequence of it? And there are fundamentally four ways to mitigate risk. We can eliminate it by changing technology or modifying plans. We can take measures to reduce the likelihood of occurrence or to reduce the impact should the event occur. Sometimes we can transfer risk through instruments such as insurance, or if a risk is small, if the impact is trivial, we may choose to simply accept it. And this would be an example of risk that we don't make a management plan to address. As we go on now to slide 41, we'll go through some ideas of how we might mitigate our risk that we have identified. For example, if we have an event where we're going to deploy in situ chemical oxidation to reduce the mass of contamination in the subsurface, as we think through that, we need to think through what are the technology objectives that we're wanting to achieve with this particular approach. Are we going to go directly to the MCL or the cleanup objective, or is this an intermediate step to reduce mass so that we can pair this with some other approach? We want to look at what are the alternatives that could be used instead of ISCO, and what are the contingencies that we need to consider before we deploy this? Do we have adequate site characterization? Do we know where the permeability or the radius of influence is? Have we really got the ability to achieve the level of contact we need? And we need to verify our design assumptions. We may need to conduct injection tests or aquifer studies to give us the information necessary to design how we would affect our technology. And then we also need to think through how we're going to measure the effectiveness of the technology once we've deployed it. And as we think through evaluating these risks, this gives us an insight in terms of whether or not this technology is feasible, or it allows us to better judge what our expected outcomes might be. We go now to slide 42, and we mentioned performance monitoring. And in terms of project risk monitoring, we want to think through what can occur and then identify those sorts of changing conditions that would impact project risk, something that would give us a clue that an adverse event is pending or that our performance is waning. This allows us then to plan ahead in terms of how to mitigate those key risks in advance rather than wait and respond to a crisis. And also it allows us to make sure that we're making good progress on our cleanup objectives. The tools and approaches that we would use are observable events, indicators that we can watch for with professional judgment, performance measures. We'll use standard cost and schedule tools that allow us to track progress. We can compare progress to earn value. And we can use other tools that may be appropriate to measure or quantify our input from stakeholders or our input from the actual technology performance measures. If we go now to slide 43, the last step of the five elements is reporting. This is the communication step where we inform all the stakeholders with how our project is going forward and how effectively our risk management plan is performing. It's essential that we inform decision makers in terms of we're on schedule or we're behind schedule, and we want to document the basis for the decisions that we've made in terms of technology assumptions or decisions to employ one technique over another. There's a number of tools that this can be integrated into in terms of our permits and decision documents. It would be a topic at our formal and informal briefings and our project meetings. It certainly would be appropriately documented in our risk management plan. And as we mentioned earlier, we want to scale this to our complexity of our project. Small sites, simple plans. Large sites warrant much more in-depth planning. If we go now to slide 44, we've mentioned stakeholders, and it's important that we talk about that because stakeholders are all the groups or individuals that are impacted by a project. It's important that we involve stakeholders early. This brings a variety of different inputs, different points of view that allow us to be more comprehensive in our planning and response. There are a number of tools that can be used to help integrate input from different stakeholders, but we want to involve them so that we can enhance our ability to get cleanup. It is important that we identify roles and responsibilities that we clearly know the roles and responsibilities of regulators, the regulated party, the persons, the engineers actually building the systems or deploying the concern. And we want to document that through our risk management plan. If we go now to slide 45, at this point I'd like to turn it over to Dave Becker. And Dave's going to share with us his some thoughts on how now to actually engage in the planning and implementation of applying these principles to your project. Dave?
Okay. Thanks, Sam. Can you hear me okay?
We can, yes.
Great. Okay. Well, let's go on to slide 46, and let me just, kind of elaborate on some of the things that Dr. Brock had just talked a little bit about, particularly on the planning. It is important to have a risk management plan, and the process is, pretty straightforward. You go ahead and draft the plan that encompasses many of the things that we'll talk about here in just a moment. And then submit that plan to a wider review process, including people who would be the subject matter experts on different aspects of the project, just to verify that the content of the plan, adequately reflects what was discussed and developed during the risk evaluation and mitigation planning. And then, of course, no plan is worth anything unless it gets implemented, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the keys to implementation here in just a bit. I do want to really emphasize that this does not have to be a standalone plan, that it can be integrated with other project planning documents, and it could just just be a component of that, so that the added cost of preparing this would be hopefully relatively trivial in the overall scheme of things, and you know, the cost incurred in preparing a plan like this, you know, would hopefully be well offset by the savings in terms of being better prepared for things that could go wrong. If we could go now to slide 47, you know, the purpose of the plan really is to provide the documentation of all that process that Dr. Brock just talked about. We want to have, you know, it, you know, in print what risks were identified, what we decided were important, what we decided to do about them. I think most everybody on the call can relate to the natural turnover that happens on a lot of these projects, particularly the longer-term projects. And to have that record is very useful for new team members that come onto the project. They can more easily get up to speed about what was done, what in terms of risk planning, and know what the plan ahead is in case some of the risks actually do come to fruition. So it is important to have that as a document in the record there. It's also important for the plan, you know, one of its purposes is to identify who the so-called risk owner is, who's going to be the one that is really tracking the potential onset of some of these risks and to decide when to implement those mitigation measures that were identified. If now we could go on to slide 49, let's talk a little bit about what goes into the plan. I mentioned a few things. Obviously, it is going to document the process that we've already discussed, everything from risk identification to the development of mitigation strategies for those important risks to, you know, documenting what monitoring would be necessary and what reporting would be necessary. Let's go on to slide 49. Certainly the plan is going to identify a strategy by which the plan itself could be updated as the project progresses. It really needs to be a living document because, as probably most everybody on the call knows, that as you go through a project, particularly as you go into major construction, active remediation, that you learn a lot and things change. Your conceptual model for the site changes, things like that. And to go back and revisit what you understand the risks to be and what the appropriate actions are is very important as your understanding of the site evolves. So you need to identify that. You know, just as it was initially, you know, it's going to involve a number of people who are going to, you know, have to think about what those risks are because the breadth of the kinds of risks that we consider. So the plan is going to identify, again, who that risk owner is, and, you know, all the risk owners are going to have to periodically reevaluate those things. It's also important for the plan to identify, you know, the communication, the reporting, the risk reporting. It needs to be clear who gets told when something actually happens. And I have a great example from a project that I've worked on for a long time, and it was a site in the Southwest where they were doing some building demolition to make room for some of the remediation activities. And as part of the building demo, they actually were encountering, you know, different piping and plumbing and things related to the building processes, and they actually broke a pipe that had fluid in it that spilled onto the ground, and it wasn't clear to the people on site what they were to do in that situation. So not knowing what was there, they went ahead and called the fire department, hazmat unit responded, turned out to just be hydraulic fluid, but it was caused a lot of consternation and, you know, unnecessary media coverage for the project, and had it been clear in a plan who to contact if some kind of spill like that occurred, it would have been able to have been managed much better. So the plan really needs to identify who's going to be told, what stakeholders need to be told when things happen. If we go now to slide 50, some other aspects of the plan content, it's going to lay out the schedule for the implementation of any of the mitigation measures, and just like the plan can be integrated into other site planning documents, the schedule for this implementation should be incorporated into the broader project schedule. as I mentioned, the plan needs to identify the record keeping. Again, because of project turnover, you know, the team members coming and going, it's good to have a record of what was, you know, what was encountered and what was done to address it, especially on long-term projects. Sometimes it's, you know, you can go back and get that lesson from a previous event if the records are clear and readily available. And the plan, the risk management plan, should identify how that's managed. The plan is also going to provide some of the tools that Dr. Brock had mentioned before. And if we go now to slide 51, we can kind of take a look at some of these different tools. And I want to emphasize that some of these tools are discussed more in Appendix D of the technical regulatory document. What's shown here on slide 51 is a risk screening checklist. This would be developed during your risk identification process. I also want to mention that when we get to the end of the webinar, on one of the last slide, actually, there's a link to another page that has some resources and some forms that you know, that we mentioned here and on subsequent slides are available in Word format for you to download and actually use in doing a risk identification and screening, mitigation planning kind of thing. So if we go to slide 52, here we have a risk analysis worksheet for a particular risk where we're actually documenting what our evaluation was of that. This particular one identifies some of the cost impacts. If you go to slide 53, we have another continuation of that worksheet that identifies some of the schedule risks as well. And again, these kind of tools, these forms would be maybe included as an appendix in the document, in the plan. If we go now to slide 54, of course, as Dr. Brock mentioned, you know, one of the key tools is the risk register. And that, of course, would be incorporated into the plan, and that would be a key thing to keep updated. You know, if there were risks identified, maybe ones that were perceived as minor early on in the process, where no mitigation strategy was felt necessary, you know, one of the things to do as the project goes on as part of the constant update for the risk management plan, to reevaluate, you know, based on what you're seeing, if that minor risk may be something more likely, maybe something more impactful that would need to have mitigation included to that. And the risk register would have to identify, you know, those kind of measures. If we go to slide 55, here's an example again of some risks listed in the risk register. Again, the register itself can be, you know, a little bit you know, broader, have some more information on it, but this kind of illustrates some of the content there. And again, Appendix D has more information about that. If we go now to slide 56, just some sort of take-home messages regarding implementation of, you know, the implementation of a risk management plan. You know, it is important to really kind of make this part of our business process. We want to incorporate these concepts, and it is just good engineering and science. We want to incorporate that into our way of doing business. It should be part of our management framework. I want to emphasize the need to revisit, you know, the risks identified and what needs to be done, so update that plan. That's important. You know, I also want to mention that this is a concept, even though it is often focused on, you know, the design for the remedy, but it has aspects that can apply to other parts of the life cycle. You know, overall, the risk management planning is something that helps us better manage resources and time. You know, it helps us keep a hold on schedule and budget. It can be something really, and this is kind of a big thing to me, that it really is a concept that should be applied during the remedy selection phase, because not all alternatives considered for remediation or corrective action are made equal, that some have more risks of failure than others, or other, you know, risks of consequences that are not so good. And that should be considered as part of, in my opinion, as part of the remedy selection process. The idea of having risk monitoring and, you know, some contingent actions based on what we identify as the onset of some of these risks can be true. You know, really that can be tied in as part of the performance metrics for remediation in general, and that's really part of the overall site closure strategy, you know, the roadmap to getting a site to its endpoint that's desired. So, you know, really I see this implementation of risk management as really kind of an integral part of overall site strategy development and implementation. So, anyway, let's go on to slide 57, and at this point, we're at our first question and answer session.
Thank you. We are going to have the break now to ask questions. From our phone line audience, you are welcome to ask questions out loud. For the simulcast audience, you can send in questions using that orange question mark button at the top of the slides. I also want to remind you at this point, at the end of the training, we are looking for you to fill out that feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. Do we have any questions to start from the phone line audience? From the simulcast, where or when do you believe RRM cannot be used?
Let's stay back here. I'll take a crack at answering that. You know, really, it does apply across a broad range or spectrum of projects. I think that, you know, it is going to be probably more applicable in the latter stages of the life cycle, you know, when you absolutely don't know anything about the site, I suppose. Everything's kind of a risk. I think that there's probably few places where, at least in some kind of qualitative sense, that it can be applied. I mean, it has pretty broad applicability.
How are new innovative methods of site remediation, such as vitrification, for example, incorporated into risk management? What procedures take place before a new remediation method is deemed to be acceptable or not acceptable?
Dave, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. Well, I think that when implementing new technologies, new remedial technologies, you know, there's often a lot of unknowns. And, you know, in particular, sometimes, you know, in my experience over the last 30 years, that, you know, some of the new technologies come in and they're almost sort of empirical. You know, it's like we know it works just because we've applied it at places, but the theoretical underpinnings of some of the technologies, you know, the physics or chemistry may not be entirely understood. And where you have, you know, those kind of uncertainties, then you have risks. And so I think that probably one of the biggest challenges with new technologies, innovative technologies right off the development stage is that you have to think about a lot about what the risks are. And given the newness, it's sometimes difficult to know all the risks. So that's going to probably be the biggest challenge. I would say that when applying something new and innovative, you know, it's all the more reason to do a thorough risk, you know, identification and evaluation and mitigation strategy development.
I'd like to echo that, and I would recommend that with a new technology, the identification of data gaps or information that you need to learn would be important to how you might develop your risk or performance monitoring, so that if you determine risk is acceptable to deploy something innovative, then it would be prudent to focus on how you're going to monitor that so that you can learn more about it and perhaps be in a better position to handle the contingencies when they occur.
What do you think is the right proportion of time and cost that we should spend on risk management for a moderately complex remediation site?
Good. That's a good question. I guess I've never really thought about it in terms of a proportion. Planning probably in general is on the orders, you know, a single-digit percent of, you know, overall investment. And, you know, obviously you do get a payback with the investment in any kind of planning, you know, good planning and risk management planning is part of good planning. You should have a good payback. But I think it's going to be on the order of single digits of the overall costs. You know, all the more reason to maybe do things more qualitatively and simply for, you know, relatively simple, inexpensive projects. You know, you don't have, you know, the potential financial risk or perhaps schedule risk with those, so you probably don't want to put in as much time on that. But the moderately complex project like you mentioned, you know, that probably, you know, would warrant, you know, more time invested, but, you know, I think it'd be probably on the order of single-digit percent. Sam, what's your experience?
I, like you, I don't know that we have an actual percentage in mind. However, the old axiom, 3 hours of, you know, every hour of planning saves you 3 hours of execution, I think is absolutely true here. But I think your estimates of single digits, but I think it needs to be done, it needs to be systematic, it needs to be thorough, and it needs to be recorded. And I think whatever amount you would spend in doing those steps would really bring dividends in terms of how the work actually proceeds once you start.
What's the biggest cost of RRM?
I guess I would say not doing it. The consequences of rework, of failed remedies, of do-overs are substantial. And I'll open this up to Ningwu and Dave, but in some of our experience in the enterprise that I work in, we find that we've operated a lot of systems that sometimes have extremely modest benefit in terms of the amount of progress it brings us, and that represents a lot of expense for activities that may with some frequency fall short of objectives. Ningwu, Dave, thoughts on that?
It's funny, Sam, that you know, I had the exact same kind of initial response, yeah, the biggest cost is not doing it. You know, I guess it depends on how you define, you know, the cost associated with RRM. You know, obviously, you know, some of the investment in the contingent actions, you know, the mitigation actions, you know, some of those, you know, may have fairly significant, you know, costs associated with them. But, you know, the idea here is that it becomes a, you know, a cost versus, you know, a cost-risk trade-off. And you know, you invest, you know, an amount that is appropriate to, you know, cover the, you know, the likelihood and the consequences of stuff. So, you know, it, again, like you say, Sam, it really should be a, you know, a cost savings down the road. So, you know, yes, there are going to be costs associated with it, but you have to think about it in terms of what you're avoiding in the way of cost too. And I think the actual planning part is relatively minor cost. Ningwu, anything that you want to add?
Yeah, I agree with you. From a regulatory point of view, sometimes we spend a lot of time ahead of the implementation. Try to identify, like I've mentioned in the training, say, what if conditions. We spend a lot of time to do the decision trees and make the flow diagram, how to implement the project, and what happened if that that, for instance, a multinational training, what if that did not occur, what are you going to do? During the planning stage, it looks like we spend a lot of time, but actually that helps in the, at the end. When we reach that point, then you could give us a better idea of how, directions, how we're going to proceed from that point. Otherwise, we're going to be in a chaos mode and in a crisis mode, and sometimes those causes are very significant at that time.
What tools can be used to involve stakeholders in the process of RRM?
There is, I think it's on the EPA website, there is a sustainable remediation tool. The Green and Sustainable Remediation Team, I think, has access to that. There is another site-wise tool that is used. These tools are used to evaluate technical alternatives, and they actually have features embedded in the tool that allows for subjective input by stakeholders so that you can graph or display the range of response from various stakeholders. Other things are a group facilitator or a team meeting. Use a whiteboard. As Dave and Ning Wu mentioned, you know, there's a number of inputs that are well adapted to qualitative judgment kind of discussions. And a lot of our facilitated meeting protocols would help build a consensus on what an approach for the site and what an approach for risk mitigation might be appropriate. And for some of the less expansive or high-dollar sites, those sorts of things would likely serve quite well.
When identifying risk levels, is it based off of guidelines or more experience-based?
The somewhat flippant answer is yes, because if it depends on your confidence with the kind of site and the technology involved, and there are a number of circumstances to where judgment-based evaluations are appropriate. Now, one of the case studies that we get into that the Department of Energy uses is this can proceed to like probabilistic risk assessments or probabilistic cost assessments. They can get rather sophisticated. However, we would probably advocate that we start off with qualitative and then use statistical or more system or quantitative measures to address specific components of a risk evaluation, such as cost or schedule or potential impacts with a catastrophic failure. Dave, Ningwo?
I would just, kind of say that at a minimum, an experienced kind of approach would be best. And I think having a number of people with different backgrounds and different levels of tenure in the field, helps because everybody brings a little bit different perspective and their own experiences to identifying the risk. And even where the team doesn't maybe have the direct experience from their own professional, project list, there are, a lot of resources available on the net, through Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable or others that has some cost and performance information, about different things that may give some insight about, what can possibly go wrong. But, yeah, I think that for, you know, a lot of sites that, you know, an experience-based kind of thing can do pretty well.
And a last question for this break. What happens if, in terms of a technology failing, laws are being violated? Should it not make sense to make sure, even in the case of the technology failing, that laws are kept with?
Ning Wu?
Yeah.
Juliana, could you repeat the question again? Sorry.
Sure. What happens if, in terms of a technology failing, laws are being violated? Should it not make sense to make sure, even in the case of technology fail, that laws are kept with?
We shouldn't have the technology failure that in kind of a violation of the regulation. For requirements, for example, if you have actually later on when they talk about the one of the examples, if you have technology failure caused the violation of emission or discharge, that has to be considered as a potential risk there. I'm not sure
that
answers the question, Dave.
I think, you know, obviously we have to comply with the laws, and failure to comply with the laws as a result of a failure would obviously be an important risk to identify. You know, if the consequences are such that there would be legal, penalties or even jail time or something like that, obviously you're going to want to, you know, consider that very carefully in your risk analysis.
Well, and I'd like to add that, as Ning Wu mentioned, is often in terms of environmental site cleanup, the fact that we need to do action to comply with a law or regulation is often what our driver is. It's not likely, perhaps, that we're going to have a failure that would put us in violation or in a new violation. However, it is really important, and the RRM process can help address this, that as it comes to effluent discharges or investigation-derived waste or the disposition of materials that we are aggregating or treating on-site, particularly if they move off-site, then the impact of how we handle that material can be quite large. For example, if we're hauling soil off-site, then we certainly do not want to run amok of hazardous waste disposal requirements, for example. And so, as Dave pointed out, this is a focus that the RRM planning should likely spend some time on in those circumstances where that sort of event is a reasonable contingency.
Thank you. For questions, if you have additional questions, you're welcome to send those in, and we'll get to those at the end of today's training. For now, let's continue on with the second half of today's training. If you have taken your phone off of mute, you can put it back on mute. It's *6 to mute in our system, or you're welcome to mute at your location. On slide 58, I'll now turn the presentation back over to Dave Becker at U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Dave?
Okay, great. And, you know, we've talked a lot about concepts here, but a lot of times it really is hard to assimilate some of the concepts unless you actually see them applied even in some kind of hypothetical example. And so our next step here with the presentation is to kind of walk through very briefly the process of risk identification, evaluation, mitigation strategy development for a hypothetical site. So let's go ahead and go now to slide 59, and we'll give a little bit of background about this hypothetical site. You know, and it is hypothetical, but it probably, you know, has attributes that are very similar to projects, you know, any of the folks on the phone have worked with at some time or another. So hopefully it's something that you'll be able to relate to. But we'll say that this site is a former plating facility in a somewhat urban setting, light industrial, bordering some residential neighborhoods. We'll say that the site is looking to be redeveloped, and they're actually looking to zone it for non-residential, perhaps commercial development instead. Historically, the plating facility, not surprisingly, you know, had waste that contained metals and solvents. Some of the liquid waste were discharged, we'll say, to an on-site pond. Some of the solid waste and sludges were buried on site. We'll say that the underlying geology consists mostly of alluvial sands that are quite permeable, but there are some clay layers and lenses. And it's all underlain by a relatively good weathered shale aquitard. Groundwater is, you know, reasonably shallow at about 20 feet. But just to make things interesting, we'll hypothesize that down gradient of the site is a municipal well that pumps on average about 450 gallons a minute when it's running. If we go now to slide 60, the site, of course, once it ceased operation and under regulatory oversight, it required some site investigation. Not surprisingly, that in groundwater, some solvents, including trichloroethylene or TCE and 111 trichloroethane TCA, as well as hexavalent chromium, were found. Some of the same compounds were also found in site soils. Unfortunately, there were just low-level whiffs, near the detection limit of trichloroethylene in the downgradient municipal well, and so that really kind of drove some urgency to this. In going through the possible remedial alternatives, it was decided that what they would do would be to treat an on-site hot spot of higher concentrations in groundwater of the solvents, in particular using in-situ chemical oxidation, or ISCO, with an appropriate oxidant. Some of the metals contaminated soil that had high concentrations would be excavated, and then to protect the municipal supply well, they would implement a wellhead treatment plant that would involve the use of an air stripper with vapor phase granular activated carbon. It was estimated that the actions would cost about $630,000. If we go now to slide 61, I want everybody to kind of put their thinking caps on now, and going back to what Dr. Brock had talked about in terms of the process for identifying risks, I want you to think, given the background that we have now on the site, what are the potential risks? And, of course, you know, there's this whole laundry list shown here on the slide of the different kinds of risks, everything from, you know, the performance risks for the selected technologies to, you know, some of the associated risks like environmental, regulatory, economic risks for the site, or even, you know, the political risks and legal risks. So, you know, based on your own experiences and, you know, what we've talked about, what do you think the risks are? And, you know, early on in the process of teaching this course, we actually taught a live session of the workshop, and we had people break into groups, and they started talking about what risks they would identify for the site. And it was very interesting to watch the dynamic with the different teams, because every individual on the team, you know, offered some perspective about the remediation risks that would be associated with this kind of site. And you know, everybody, as I mentioned before, everybody brings a different perspective and background and experience portfolio with them to these kind of discussions. So this kind of emphasizes the need to have a team member approach to developing these things, and to bring people with different backgrounds, you know, together, so that you are more thorough in identifying the risks. So, anyway, if you've had a chance to think about it, now let's go ahead and go on to slide 62, and we'll talk about what risks the RRM team actually came up with for the site. And we'll start with the remedy performance risk. Well, you know, not surprisingly, with an in-situ remediation technology like chemical oxidation, there's always a risk that you're not going to be able to fully treat your target medium. And, you know, a lot of times that with ISCO in particular, it's, you know, a matter of incomplete contact or inadequate dosing for, you know, for treating what you've got there. So that's a risk. For the excavation, you know, one of the, you know, potential of a site like this in particular is that you might encounter drums or other debris while you're excavating that would really complicate the handling and transport and disposal of some of the material. You would also maybe identify a risk with the vapor phase granular activated carbon at the wellhead treatment system where a breakthrough might occur and exceeding some kind of emission standard for the local area. You know, the wellhead treatment itself, the air stripper, may be inadequate in treating to the desired concentrations, and that would have, you know, a fairly significant consequence of delivering contaminated water above the maximum contaminant level. So that would be, you know, the kind of risk that we'd look at there. If we go now to slide 63, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other risks. Well, what about human health risks? And I'm not talking about the health risks associated with the exposure to the contaminants themselves, but the health risks and safety risks associated with actually implementing the remediation. So, you know, you've got transportation potentially of the excavated soil. If those trucks go through residential neighborhoods, well, you have accident risks. You know, people might get hit by a truck, those kind of things. And then, of course, you know, anytime you've got, you know, excavation or other kind of remedial activities going on at the site, there's always the worker risk, too. You know, in excavation, you've got heavy equipment. With ISCO, you've got, you know, potentially strong oxidants that could cause chemical burns and, you know, things like that. So those are risks that would be, you know, associated with the project. Some of the environmental ecological risks, well, you know, incorporating greenhouse gas emissions and carbon footprint kind of impacts, you know, there's certainly risks, if you want to call them that, associated with that, with, you know, the emissions from the equipment and the amendments, the, you know, the emissions associated with manufacturing of the amendments and placing them and things like that, as well as the electrical costs and impacts for, say, the pumps and blowers on the air stripper. Another attribute, too, another risk would be the consumption of landfill space for off-site disposal of the excavated material. So that's a different kind of risk. If we go now to slide 64, some other risks, there may be regulatory project risks where the schedule could be impacted if the review by the regulatory agencies of site-related documents you know, is difficult to accomplish within a scheduled amount of time. There may also be some regulatory risks in terms of the regulatory standards that have to be complied with changing during the course of the project. Economic risks could be, you know, the beneficial reuse of the site, the redevelopment of the site. There may be economic risks associated with changing land values and demand for commercial space, things like that. Schedule risks and staffing risks, you know, those are things that we really didn't talk about, but those are ones that, you know, might play into a particular site. Legal and political risks, there may be challenges to any rezoning that's proposed for the site, or the community may actually, you know, be mobilized to oppose the project because of perceived risks or whatever, and those could affect the project schedule as well. So if we go now to slide 65, here's actually a slide that we've seen before. It's the same as slide 52, but it's the risk analysis worksheet for one of those risks that we just got done talking about. In this case, it's the risks associated with or the impacts associated with cost. Slide 55 actually shows the kind of the discussion of the risk associated with the schedule from that particular risk event in this case, the effectiveness of the in-situ chemical oxidation. If we go now to slide 66, here's a table showing some of the risks that we just talked about in terms of, you know, the impact severity, the likelihood of occurrence, and the overall risk level. And you can see that, you know, there were several of the risks that we talked about that actually had a high-level risk because they were relatively likely to occur and they had significant impacts to cost and schedule. So things like availability of key personnel or the growth in excavation volumes or encountering drums of debris during the excavation or the incomplete treatment by in-situ chemical oxidation. Those were all identified as high-level risks. If we go now to slide 67, I want everybody to, again, put on your thinking caps. And now that we've talked about some of the risks for this hypothetical site, what could be done to mitigate these risks? You know, how are we going to manage the ones? We've categorized them. You know, we're going to focus on the ones that have, you know, relatively high to moderate levels of risk. Maybe we'll accept the ones that have low levels of risk. But what are we going to do about them? And so, again, you know, bringing together, you know, the same broad background team, you know, you would want to discuss those kind of things. You know, everybody's going to have, you know, maybe some ideas on how to most cost effectively and time effectively address some of these risks. So if we go now to slide 68, we'll talk a little bit about how the RRM team identified some mitigation strategies for these different risks. So we'll again start with the remedy performance risks and the risks associated with the incomplete chemical oxidation success. You know, some of the things that you could do to mitigate that would be to, well, increase the amount of oxidant that you inject. And you might do that by, you know, adding additional injection points to decrease the spacing between them or to inject more in individual locations. You may want to do additional site characterization to better understand where the contaminant is and how the hydrogeology might affect the delivery of the oxidant. We may want to include financial contingencies within our budget to account for the potential for subsequent additional injection events to target areas that didn't respond as well for the earlier injection event with ISCO. In terms of some of the mitigation strategies for the excavation risks, particularly the encountering drums and debris, well, you might want to go out and do a geophysical survey to see if you've got evidence of buried metal at the site to give you some insight before you start digging. You may want to have the contractor, you know, the construction contractor, actually bring the appropriate equipment on site or have it available on short notice that would be able to handle drums, some kind of drum grappler and, you know, overpack drums, have those available. You know, if you've got those available, that would mitigate some of the particularly schedule risks associated with having to shut the project down. If we go now to slide 69, we'll continue discussing some of the remedy performance risks here. What about the treatment failure at the wellhead treatment plant? Well, in terms of the vapor phase carbon, you know, if we're worried about breakthrough on that, we could install larger carbon vessels such that it gives us, you know, longer between changeouts, less, you know, more capacity for a given monitoring program. You know, we'd have more warning. We may want to increase our frequency of monitoring the vapor concentrations between the vessels at the site so that we know when breakthrough is, you know, more imminent. We may want to use virgin carbon instead of regenerated carbon that would have a higher absorption capacity potentially for these contaminants. Anyway, if we look at some of the other risks, including the human health or worker protection, you know, in terms of the accident risk for the trucks driving through the neighborhoods, well, we might want to reroute, you know, the truck haul routes such that they avoid residential neighborhoods, that we may want to target times at where traffic volume is lower. You know, if we may want to actually, you know, block off parts of the streets where trucks are going to be coming in and out quite regularly or something like that, so we could engineer some of those kinds of things. In terms of the worker protection, worker accident risks, well, we could, you know, implement more sophisticated engineering controls that would reduce the accident risk. Just good health and safety practices and redundancies and safety measures. If we go now to slide 70, you know, some of the other risks here, the environmental ecological risks, we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions and the associated risks by using rail for transporting the excavated material instead of trucks. We may want to use a clean diesel or even a biofuel to run our equipment. We can minimize our emissions for the equipment by, you know, only excavating the material that really needs to be excavated. We could do that through the additional characterization work that we kind of talked about before. If we design the above ground treatment system with variable frequency drive electric motors for the pumps and blowers, we can better tailor our operating set points with minimal energy costs. And just properly sizing the equipment can also help that. In terms of preserving landfill space, again, by only excavating and shipping off-site for disposal the necessary volume of soil, we can minimize the use of that limited resource as well. If we go now to slide 71, some of the other risks and the mitigation strategies from the regulatory risks, if we're worried about the availability of timely review by some of the agencies, we may want to coordinate early with the regulatory agencies, give them advance notice about when the documents will be there, work with them to develop a reasonable schedule that works for them such that everybody has realistic expectations. In some cases, you know, for Department of Defense anyway, we actually help reimburse the regulatory agencies for the review of the submittals so that they have the adequate resources to do that. Some of the economic risks, looking at, early coordination with the municipal authorities, looking at, you know, what kind of concerns they might have about the rezoning, work to immediately and early to address some of those concerns might reduce the impacts of some kind of challenge to the rezoning. If we're worried about the economic risks associated with the redevelopment, you know, in the market, we may want to, identify certain parts of the site to clean up first, in order to make that available for redevelopment and generate some cash flow that can, keep us going economically in a better shape, as the project goes on. In terms of some of the legal and public perception risks, again, early outreach to not only the municipal authorities but also to the public, and to educate them about what's going on and to listen to their concerns and engineer around, some of their concerns, would pay some benefits. That's what we came up with in terms of some of the mitigation strategies for some of the risks that we talked about. But you get the idea of, what would be involved with the identification and evaluation and mitigation strategy development. So if we go now to slide 72, what would be some of the monitoring and reporting questions that would come up for a site like this? Well, we would obviously have to sit down and think about what, the sequence of mitigation strategies would be, as I mentioned in the planning document, we would want to identify how, any responses to risk onset would be, addressed, who it's reported to. Other decisions would be, are we going to incorporate our risk management plan into other plans and schedules, which is often a good idea. Who's going to be involved with monitoring and taking action on different risks? Again, identifying who the risk owner is in the plan. Identifying who among the stakeholders would need to know about the onset of any of these particular risks. So those would all be addressed in the risk management plan. If we go now to slide 73, I just kind of want to throw something, you know, a little bit of a wrench in here, kind of, you know, illustrate how the risk management plan needs to be a living document and how we need to revisit that. Let's say for our particular site that, you know, one of the actions as part of the remedy was to replace an existing monitoring well that was going to be affected by the excavation. Maybe we're moving it out of the footprint of the excavation or something like that. Let's say that during the installation and sampling of that new well, we identify some dense non-aqueous phase liquid or DNAPL in that well. We didn't have any idea that there was DNAPL present at the site before. This changes our conceptual model. This may change the our perception of the risks associated with the site. Obviously, you know, we would hopefully have thought about, you know, at least in general, something unexpected like this happening, who we're going to report that to, what regulatory and municipal authorities are we going to notify that, and how we would notify them about that. And then, you know, revisiting the whole concept of the risks at the site, then, you know, maybe the presence of DNAPL is going to change how we're going to manage the site or the strategy that we're going to have for taking the site to a point where it can be redeveloped. You know, it may have a lot of ramifications. So, you know, the idea here is that the team is going to have to reevaluate the risk in general. So, anyway, let's go now to slide 74. And at this point, rather than talking about hypothetical stuff, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Sam Brock from Air Force Center Engineering and the Environment to talk about some case studies.
Juliana, can you hear me? I'm off mute.
You are off mute. Thank you.
Okay. What we want to do now is go through a series of about four case studies. They represent a variety of sites in terms of size and complexity and where they were at in terms of the site life cycle. And go through this to kind of help you think about you know, as we pointed out, this is kind of what we do intuitively in terms of applying the scientific method, but these examples will give us some ideas of how the concepts can be applied. If we go now to slide 75, it'll illustrate the objective and the importance of RRM. You can see how the different principles and the elements are applied, and the cases give a range of complexity. If we go now to slide 76, we'll start off with a site, and this is in California, in Ningwu's neighborhood, where it was an industrial facility with on-site disposal operations. The chemicals of concern were volatile contaminants in groundwater. And it was at the remedial design stage, and the regulatory oversight then, at the point of remedy design, in the design review stage, actually looked at the risk elements and the risk management, risk mitigation steps that could be employed. You know, it was constrained by site conditions that don't favor in situ treatments. The selected remedy was a pump and treat system for containment. It required a low-profile airstripper because of the neighborhood setting, and we had to consider the hazard operations that were associated with operating that sort of a system. If we go now to slide 77, the risk mitigation focused on the design review, and the design issues then were addressed to look into whether the design was sufficiently flexible and had the capacity to expand as might be necessary to achieve treatment goals. And as would be expected, several items were identified that could be addressed in the O&M contingency plan or in the design specifications. But the risk management was recorded. The risk register was recorded on a simple spreadsheet, similar to the TechReg document, and then the various follow-up actions were enumerated in terms of design changes or contingency to be factored into the O&M. If we go now to slide 78, this eye chart is, we don't intend to read it in detail, but we did try to blow up one line of one element, dealing in this case with the piping component, to just give you an idea of how it worked. The what if was, if the piping were to leak, what would be the hazard? Well, it's exposure to workers or, could be a surface release. The consequence would be the system, would have to operate longer because of the leak. Of course, the consequences of worker health. And, then the, safeguard that was employed in design was to, specify secondary containment, so that the, pipe could, if it did leak, would be contained, and then to also verify that the material used to assemble the system was according to manufacturer specifications with regards to compatibility with chemicals and pressure requirements and that sort of thing. And you can look through the rest of this. If we go now to slide 79, this is Tyson's Lagoon. This example is in the tech rag. It's an old NPL site in Pennsylvania. It was abandoned waste disposal. Liquid waste and sludges were disposed in a series of unlined lagoons. Contained a substantial list of VOCs, toluene, trichloropropane, and xylenes. And actually, this project at the time of the risk mitigation was at the remedy implementation stage. In the first example, it was remedy design. This is at remedy implementation. But at the implementation stage, based on the investigation, was to excavate the materials and dispose off-site. But as a consequence of further pilot studies that were implemented for treating the material, and then also a project risk evaluation that was part of the proposed plan discussion, the remedy was actually reconsidered. If we go now to slide 80, the evaluation disclosed, and this was in part, I think, because of community input, was that there was a substantial potential for release of volatiles to the atmosphere, and a concern was that the exposure during those volatilization periods would be unacceptable. And the alternative then was actually modified to bring in an innovative at the time technology, which would do vacuum extraction. And so the recommendation was to replace the excavation with soil vapor extraction. And this example would somewhat address the issue of how to deal with innovative technologies. If we go now to slide 81, this is the third site, which is it's a filling station, light auto maintenance and fuel dispensing, happened to be on an Air Force base in Utah. And there had been leaking of the storage tanks and dispensing piping. The L-NAPL plume, the actual BTEX, was rather shallow, a limited length. We can see that in the green plume on the figure here. The red was the L-NAPL or free product that was closely located with the point of release. As we go to the green now, I misspoke. As we go to green, we have TCE that was secondary to releases from some of the parts cleaning with the light maintenance that went on. We noticed that the depth of the TCE as it migrates away from the point of release is going deeper. We're now down to 50 to 100 foot depths, although site conditions were such that that plume appeared to be receding. But then as we go to a greater depth, that greater distance from the point of release, we see MTBE as a gasoline additive that is migrating to several hundred feet away from the point of release. So we have a complex site with complex geology and mixed contaminants. If we go now to slide 82, at the point the particular consultation was rendered on this site, it was at the remedy selection stage. Several alternatives were considered in the feasibility study, and actually the project was headed toward the construction of a pump and treat system for containment. But based on technical evaluation of the hydrogeology and the geology, the nature of the contaminants, there was concern about whether the reliability of the pump and treat system could be maintained. There were also considerations of how to evaluate these, and going back into the subjective versus quantitative tools, at our center here we had a risk estimating model, if you will, that is subjectively operated but puts it through some more semi-qualitative, quantitative statistical procedures. We deployed a technology based on an in-house risk remediation risk guidance. We identified 39 events and then ran that through our system to come up with some recommendations. Slide 83 is just to give you an idea of the sorts of risks that were considered. It looked at the technical analysis, the political analysis, and then also the regulatory perspectives and standards dealing with the ability to reach the numerical objective as well as the receptivity of the community to other approaches. And it summed that all up into a score that would give you an assessment of the uncertainty as to what would constitute an acceptable level of risk. At slide 84, evaluation then looked at the relative importance of the uncertainties. We looked at lessons learned from other technologies deployed on the facility, and we were encountering a substantial problem with biofouling in terms of similar pump and treat systems, and we determined that actually that problem might be part of the solution, with the potential then for enhanced bioremediation as an alternative to pump and treat. It was identified that that sort of innovative approach would require treatability studies to evaluate it further before a firm commitment to put that into a decision document. But the recommendation was then that the risk of pump and treat could be greater than the risk of monitored natural attenuation or enhanced natural attenuation, because the system could spread the contaminant and then there would be a problem with system reliability that capture might be incomplete. If we go now to slide 85, this is a DOE site that represents our most really complex site. And you'll notice a lot of similarities in the DOE model and the RRM guidance, and that's really on purpose because DOE was very active on the team that produced the guidance. But this particular site is large. It has a variety of contaminants of concern. There's a variety of several different treatment technologies in terms of remediation technology. There's considerable uncertainty inherent in the nature of the site concerning the scope of action and the schedule required, the long duration to clean it up. If we go now to slide 86, we see here the summation of or the summary version of the risk register that was used to assess the risk evaluation of one of the remedial elements, and we see here that the probability was judged. This was set by expert committee. The cost impacts are the result of a probabilistic cost estimating model. You'll see that 5% of the cost represents $47 million. It's a large impact, and consequently, the sophistication of the method is bigger. And then the expected value then for the contingency planning that factors into the budgeting process is shown there as $2.3 million. And we see here that Mike T is the responsible person or the event owner. So as Dave pointed out, this example has a specific person assigned to track and account for monitoring the risk. If we go now to slide 87, on this Site 300 case study, there's a variety of steps here in terms of measures that can be used to reduce risk or mitigate it, including adjusting schedules, substituting less complicated processes, reallocation of resources, and considering alternative technologies. And then also examples of how to track the risk are then to do the ongoing measures to verify whether the strategy assumptions are valid. In other words, once you make an assumption, let's follow up to verify that it's as expected, to ensure the mitigations are actually implemented, and then test to verify that they are having the expected result. Also, as we mentioned at the beginning, as the progress goes forward, you may identify new risks, Dave's example of the den apple in a monitoring well, but that can take a variety of other unexpected discoveries. And then, of course, the objective is to look for trends in performance or changing site conditions. If we go now to slide 88, implementation of the risk mitigation, it was a qualitative process to identify risk. It included sophisticated analysis. The mitigation activities were included in the actual work plans for the construction of CAPS and the implementation of systems. The risk handling then was embedded in the risk management plan, and to date, at least at the time of publication, 20 risk events had been realized. The risk mitigation activities had successfully accommodated or mitigated 18 of those events, and then two of the events required modification to treatment systems to adapt to, for example, changing regulatory standards. So by way of summary, to try to bring this all together, risk is inherent in all of our remediation operations. The RRM process is based on the principles of plan, execute, and verify your planning. It's built on the five elements of execution, which is to identify risks, evaluate them, plan mitigation actions, conduct monitoring, and then report the consequences of monitoring so that the decision makers and stakeholders are fully informed. It's a dynamic process. It's intended to focus on key risks, to track those important events that need to be managed, and to enhance communication. It's believed and demonstrated that it leads to better management practices, and it's based on proven methodologies to identify and mitigate risk. It's scalable, and the overall objective is that it will benefit the environment through successful remediation and better, more rapid site cleanup. We would invite you to use the ITRC document. There is an RRM2 document that addresses risk management at complex groundwater sites, And also, we would invite you to use the RRM team members for collaboration or discussion if you have questions on the on implementing the process. If we go now to slide 90, I'll turn it back over to Juliana.
Thanks, Sam. We are going to have time for questions and answers. We're scheduled to go until 15 minutes after the hour, so we will have time to answer your questions. You are welcome to start sending those in using the orange question mark button at the top of the slide. Before we get to those questions and answers, I do want to take you to our links page and our feedback form. So you're welcome to select either area of the slide. If you do go to the links page first, looking to the left on the Clue In Sun, the third button down takes you to the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide and appreciate you taking just a few minutes now to give us your feedback. Looking at the links page, the first item, download today's ITRC training, that's what allows you to download the PowerPoint presentation. In addition to what you see on the slides during today's class, there's more information available in the notes section of the downloaded version. We talked today about the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Project Risk Management for Site Remediation. We call it the RRM-1 document. This next link is going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of the document, as well as the second document, the Remediation Risk Management to Address Groundwater Cleanup Challenges at Complex Sites. So that's the RRM-2 document. That's also available to download, and Sam just mentioned that one. We also have a Word document with templates, some of the things we talked about today for the risk register. We have put together a template for you. You're welcome to download those. In addition, we have some ITRC links on some past items on the remediation process optimization available here. So these are some of the ITRC resources that are available and connected to today's training. I encourage you to check the ITRC website. We have many resources available. And Section 2 has some websites and documents. Some of these we've mentioned during today's training class, so they're available for you here. Also, the final links take you to the ITRC website and also the CLUIN website, where you can see upcoming classes and as well as archives of past classes. So much more training is available on through both the ITRC website and the CLUIN website. You can access those. We do now want to get to as many questions as we can for the next 15 minutes. So if you are in the simulcast audience, you do need to go back to the slides. It's the orange question mark that allows you to send in questions. And, of course, anyone is welcome to send in questions that way. For the phone line audience, you have the additional option of unmuting your phone. It's #6 to unmute your phone and send in questions. Do you have any questions to start from the phone line audience? Remember, #6 to unmute in our system. We have a simulcast question that refers to slide 69 and slide 70. So if you are in the CLUIN version, along the left is a list of slide numbers, and you can use that list to jump forward and backwards. In slide 69, you suggest how it can be better to install large vessels and use virgin carbon, while slide 70 says how landfills should be used. This adds pressure on materials and landfills. So could the RRM not be done with a more environmental-friendly manner?
Okay, well, you know, that's a good point. You know, I guess that, you know, the larger vessels requires more carbon, but, you know, it overall, you know, the amount of carbon would probably be comparable. It's just a matter of how frequently you'd have to change it. And I guess my presumption would have been that the carbon may not have been landfill, but would have potentially been regenerated for other use. You know, obviously, you know, in evaluating, you know, the potential mitigation strategies, you know, there are going to be some trade-offs. And, you know, to look at some of the options, you know, you're also going to want to look at what the environmental footprint is going to be for some of those actions. So, you know, we threw out some possible options there, and, you know, the ultimate decision, you know, would potentially consider what those environmental footprints would be as well. So hopefully that gets to the question.
The example site involving HTRW contamination, would implementing RRM for a MEC site be the same and or similar?
Okay. To define some acronyms there, the HDRWB, Hazardous Toxic Radioactive Waste type project, you know, more like, you know, what we were talking about. An MEC site would be a munitions and explosives of concern, which would be, you know, unexploded ordnance kind of things. I think the process would certainly be, comparable. I think that there are some risks that are going to be high just because the potential consequences of, you know, having something go wrong my understanding of the explosive safety process associated with addressing munitions and explosives of concern, that they're very risk conscious and they have very detailed procedures for managing those risks. And so I think that it would be probably a natural transition to take the concepts we've presented here and apply them, you know, in a broader sense, you know, at MEC sites. Sam, did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, actually, the MEC sites are subjected to a scoring protocol that systematically goes through the nature of the components present, the proximity of receptors, and a variety of things. There's about 40 different worksheets that go through a very systematic application of RRM principles. It's been tailored to the MEC sites, and it focuses primarily on acute risk. RRM would supplement that further as you look into the various limitations of technology and the other elements of is the best you can do acceptable and the other components of what a final remedy would have to include. It's the hazard risk scoring system. I've forgotten the exact name of it, but there's a DOD directive that lays that scoring out.
That the MRSPP
concept? Yeah.
Yes. The munitions response site prioritization protocol or something like that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. For our audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. Remember #6 to unmute, and you can also type in questions. Sam mentioned the RRM-2 document. Can you tell us more about that?
Thank you, Juliana. This is a document that was produced as a companion document to RRM, which is the tech reg that we've trained on today. It focuses on the more complex groundwater sites that have extreme limitations to deploying technology effectively to get material in or to get material out. And it summarizes a variety of sites where technical impracticability waivers have been granted. It marches through a description of alternative approaches to managing sites where full remediation is either not feasible or extremely protracted. And it gives some insights on how ARAR waivers could be necessary in order to implement other approaches or combination of approaches such as groundwater management zones, point of compliance, land use controls that are necessary to accomplish a protective remedy at those sites. And it's a pretty pretty comprehensive discussion of that topic in 2012.
Thank you. I do want to wait just another minute or two for simulcast questions. Do we have a question from the phone line audience? Ning Wu, while we're waiting, can you tell us about some of the new teams that you've participated in since the RRM?
Sure. Since the RRM team, we move on to some statistical analysis team here. First one, we talk about groundwater statistics, and we finished that document, and the training is also available. I think we just had the training a few weeks ago. And currently, we're move on to another topic using the geostatistics approach or methods for remediation optimization concept here. It's kind of a combination of the statistics and also the optimization methods or approaches so, that previous RPO team that tried to provide. And that also could help to manage some of the risk here, and because we're using the geostatistics methods to help to identify some of the help to minimize or maximize the possibility of closure. Dave is also on the team working on some of the concept here. And Dave, you have anything to add?
Yeah, thanks, Ning Wu. I would just kind of add one thing that really the geostatistics, as we're kind of addressing it in this new team, helps identify some of the uncertainties with our understanding of a site, for example. And that uncertainty, of course, translates to risk. And so, these are some tools that may help us manage risk and identify risk. So I think there's some natural overlap or correlation between that team and what we've just gotten done talking about.
Right.
Thank you. And for the groundwater statistics, the name of the training class is Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers. That's coming up again on December 16th, so registration is now open for that class. And for the geostatistics, they're a few years away yet from offering training, so if you are interested in learning more, you can visit the ITRC website to learn more about that team as well as other active ITRC teams. We don't have any new questions, so we'll go ahead and wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use that information. For more information about ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website, which is www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.